CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where we talk about what, Marielle?
Comics.
There we go. She's
and
not
geeks.
Shut up. That was Sex Pistols Bodies. It's just about 5 minutes past two, 6 minutes, maybe 7 minutes. We're a little late starting today, but that's
Sorry.
Okay. I love carrying a guilt trip. Today's guest is Blake Bell. We are going to talk about Blake's new book, The Strange World of Steve Ditko. Of course, I immediately realized I didn't. What's the full title, Blake?
The full title is Strange and Stranger, The World of Steve Ditko.
There we go. I missed a stranger. So Strange and Stranger, The World of Steve Ditko will be out in stores the 25th.
I'm praying for the 25th. That would be nice. It's out at Jim Hanley's Universe in New York City right now. It'll be out at the Beguiling in Toronto for the big event that we're hosting next Wednesday night. That's the 18th. And then hopefully the direct market will have it by the 25th, if not the following Wednesday. And you should see it in regular bookstores, I would suspect, the very first week of July.
Excellent. And I highly recommend folks to go by Jim Hanley's in New York and the Beguiling in Toronto. I haven't been to Beguiling, but I've been to Hanley's, and Hanley's is a fantastic shop. When I was in New York, it was the one I enjoyed the most, even though I didn't make it to Rocket Ship. So there we go. I can't say nothing about Rocket Ship. So tell us, I guess we'll talk about who Steve Ditko is, kind of some background history on him. And then we'll for people that don't know, we'll talk about who he is. I guess we'll start out with why you should know who Steve Ditko is, a little background, and then we'll get into why is he strange and stranger. So how about who is Steve Ditko, Blake?
Steve Ditko is the co-creator and original artist of such characters as The Amazing Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, and his own personal character, Mr. A. That only encompasses a small part of his career, which extended back as far as 1953, at a small stint in the Joe Simon and Jack Kirby studio in that summer, and continues to this very day. He just put out another book of mainly essays, but a little bit of artwork, back there in April of this year, and he's, by the back cover of that book, he is suggesting he's going to have another new book out, full of actual new stories and new characters. And since he was born in 1927 in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, that would make him one of the few artists to still be putting out new stories and characters in their 80s. So
wow.
he's still going strong.
Wow. So why was Steve Ditko such an interest of doing a book? And it's not just a book, it's an epic look into his career and his art, and also, I guess, a criticism of his work as well. It's thrown in,
yes,
too.
Yes, there's I guess the one reason was because there was a vacuum. No one had really done an examination along the lines that we had, or we have. There was an attempted shot at it back in the early 80s with Eclipse Comics, who tried to do an art of Steve Ditko, but that project collapsed. And perhaps under its own weight, but also the weight of, thousands and thousands of tons of water that flooded the area that Dean Mullaney and Cat Ironwood resided in at the time, and just took the book with it under, feet of mud and clay, and that sort of kiboshed that project in the mid-80s. So there was certainly, a quote-unquote need to have an actual volume like this done on a particular subject who is, worthy of that. And, for my purposes, I think it's just been a lifelong interest in his work dating back to when I would have discovered him back in the late 70s, those little pocketbooks that they reprinted about six issues each of Spider-Man, the original Ditko Lee run. And it was amazing to even me as a child that those, looking back now, those books clearly spoke, quite easily and read very easily to a young child, as they do. My son Luke is now 8 years old, and they read incredibly easy, and that's a compliment to Ditko's storytelling ability. Yet, as an adult, there's a lot more that is revealed there as well, and you can deconstruct the work and get a lot of value out of it, too. So, once you have that type of combination, it really begs for a volume that that, you know, takes a look at the work itself, but also the career of the individual.
What are some of his more breakthrough interesting works before we really get into the character that is Steve Ditko? Maybe talk about some of his stronger works, what really stands out and why he's important in the comics world.
Well, I think there's a particular page in Spider-Man number one where he has rescued the son of J. Jonah Jameson, you know, the publisher of the Daily Bugle, whose son went up in a spacecraft and came, a spacecraft, probably not the best word, but and it came crashing back down towards Earth, and Spider-Man saved the son. So Peter Parker, coming home after that triumph, figured he had it all licked, all his personality concerns, you know, feeling like a, you know, a meek geek, and, you know, chastised in school for being that sort of bookworm. He figured he had all that particular concerns, you know, licked, and that he was the next version of Captain America, the, you know, the geek who had received all these superpowers and gone on to a better life. But when he returns home, he sees the cover of the Daily Bugle is actually painting him as a masked villain, as a vigilante who should be exposed and captured. And at that particular moment in time, he realizes that, wow, these powers that I've been given that were supposed to take care of all my problems are in fact going to make my life a lot worse. And I think that particular moment in comic books history is really the fulcrum with which the whole industry has, you know, been bent on over the past almost 70 years. And so that alone would make it, you know, his connection to that book, you know, revolutionary as it was. But then when you also get, you factor in the Doctor Strange work, mm-hmm, and how really for the first time and perhaps the only time, he was able to create all of these dimensions seemingly from nothing but, you know, geometric shapes. Whereas previous people who had tried to describe magic visually would just do it with, you know, clouds and smoke and, you know, wisps of smoke. So he had that to his credit. And I think the third that you could point to is his character Mr. A that he debuted in Wally Wood's, we'll call it a magazine. It was really an offbeat particular publication that wasn't part of the big two publishers. And Ditko debuted this character, Mr. A, based on Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism. In fact, you know, taking the name from a chapter in Atlas Shrugged, A equals A. And this is one of the first times that, you know, hardcore philosophical ideas had been injected into the comic book medium. And they obviously came at a time, you know, Ayn Rand's philosophy, you know, being considered somewhat right-wing, if you will, certainly not left-wing in terms of the tenor of the times, you know, with the Summer of Love in 67 and, you know, that sort of hippie leftist feel. Mm-hmm. And this was very jarring to the comic books community. I remember Batten Lash, the creator of Supernatural Law, saying that he would go to comic conventions at that time and people were in love with the Neil Adams Green Lantern, Green Arrow books, but they were appalled by this Ditko material. And Batten's quote that I have in the book is that, you know, most cartoonists' definition of you know, creating controversy is whether or not there's a circle around the Batman logo or not. Whereas here was, you know, the chest emblem. Whereas here was Ditko basically allowing villains to drop to their death, figuring they weren't even worth saving. Mm-hmm. And that's that famous page in the first Mr. A story where the villain of the piece is hanging by a flagpole as if, you know, to sort of, you know, poke a stick at the Spider-Man work that he had done. And the victim, who's been stabbed by this criminal, Mr. A forces this person, the victim, to make a choice to say, you know, do you want me to save the character Angel who stabbed you, or do you want me to save you? And, of course, this character is a very lefty liberal and can't make up their mind who should be saved, which is another commentary by Ditko on that. So he grabs the victim, carries her off, lets the criminal fall to his death, and then says, you know, I wouldn't have even saved that criminal, even if I had the time, because they don't deserve any type of, you know, that would be sanctioning them as opposed to, you know, caring for the victim. So these were really revolutionary ideas that were going on at the time. And I think those three examples, really what, you know, if you had to put out reasons why Steve Ditko deserves to be up at the top of, you know, the scale of, you know, creators who are able to bring revolutionary ideas into the field, those would be three of them.
Well, we may not agree with it. He was doing honest storytelling to himself, I guess.
I'm sorry?
Even if we may not agree with what he was saying with the Mr. A stuff, he was still being honest with the story that he wanted to tell.
Yeah, well, Alan Moore once, I think, said it best. He said, even though I disagree with all of Steve's politics, he certainly deserves to, you know, be credited with actually, you know, having ideas and bringing them into the medium.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone, especially when you think back, you know, this is 40 years ago. This is, you know, when comics were still considered, you know, 10-cent, 12-cent throwaway items for kids. And here he is doing this type of work that he couldn't even get into, to, you know, the mainstream companies. He would try, you know, around that time through, you know, Hawk and the Dove and The Question. But, you know, again, very difficult to imagine that 40 years ago that he was dealing with this type of ideas and trying to inject it into, the, you know, what is really a superhero medium at the time.
The Doctor Strange, the interesting thing about that is that it became very iconic for that generation of people as well, the 60s. The hippies, they loved the Doctor Strange, but he had no interest in that culture. And it's interesting that the imagery he used was so powerful with the psychedelics folks, but he was obviously not partaking in the substance of choice.
Yeah, no, I think that's... you're right. I think, and Ditko certainly had or exhibited a lot of contempt for that that lefty hippie ideology. Even in the last issue of Spider-Man, Peter Parker is seen walking through a, you know, a campus protest, and, you know, the Peter Parker, you know, who would have done anything in Amazing Fantasy 15, the first appearance of Spider-Man, to be part of that crowd. Ditko transformed him into sort of Ayn Rand's ideal of a young hero, a sort of romantic male hero. And here he was, you know, 38, 39 issues later, deriding this group as, you know, people who were just protesting for the sake of protesting. And then if you toss in that whole, you know, drug culture and, you know, the transformation of one's mind, I can't imagine that would have sat well with an objectivist who thought, you know, that the rational mind was, you know, man's only separation from the animal. And can't imagine that you know, someone who is considered rather straight-laced like Ditko being anything but appalled by, you know, their interpretation of his one of his major strips.
Why did he latch onto objectivism so thoroughly?
I think Bat and Lash again once said to me that, you know, many people who have read, you know, her two famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, have already had a lot of these ideas sort of swimming around in their heads about individualism, about, you know, the producer versus the looter, the idea that you don't compromise your beliefs just for a buck. You don't sell them out like that. A lot of people have had these thoughts in their heads, and she was the first one to sort of put it out there in a simplified form, you know, with a great plot, if you will. I think she would have been a great comic book plotter. Wrapped it in a simple form so that people could sort of, you know, congeal that in their head. And clearly, when you look at, you know, the work Ditko had done, even in the 50s, he was already someone who was interested in becoming, you know, in pushing the medium. Mm-hmm. He was not, as the first generation of cartoonists in comics might have been, you know, people who are, you know, biding time and they could until they could get into illustration. He really came in as one of the leaders of that second generation in the 50s who had influences from the previous generation in comic books and really was solely interested in becoming a comic book artist and pushing the medium in that fashion. And you could see that in some of the work where, again, there's obviously a lot more detail and a lot more thought put into what are really, you know, just very generic genre stories. And so, you know, I think you start to see some of that, you know, in very small sense, forming that he is, you know, an individual to begin with.
One thing you do a lot with the book is you do a lot of comparison between his work and older work. What were some of the really standout stuff that influenced Ditko?
Well, I think his two biggest influences growing up would have been Will Eisner's The Spirit. You know, living in Pennsylvania, he would have been pretty close to Philadelphia papers to be able to grab that The Spirit section out of the newspapers, and you can see a lot of that use of light and dark that Eisner had, and the brushwork in some of Ditko's, especially his earlier work. Clearly, Jerry Robinson, who was one of the initial artists and creator of the Joker from, you know, in the Batman strip, would have been someone that was an influence because he actually went and went to school and was taught by Jerry Robinson in New York in the early 50s. So those are two, big influences and inspirations. And as you see in the book, I think Mort Meskin is another big influence. There's a lot of, even the cover of the book has those sort of, drifting heads around that figure. And that's almost lifted right from a Golden Lad cover that we show in the book, where all those multiple faces are swarming around the hero. So, that and, a Joe Kubert is very similar in the early to mid-50s. So those would be, four of the people who had clearly informed, Ditko's style up to that point.
And he did some work with Meskin, right?
Yeah, Meskin would have been working in the Simon and Kirby studio in that summer of 1953. How much work they did, specifically together is not known, other than them, inking backgrounds to, Captain 3D and things like that. But the 3D fad, phased out pretty quick, so Ditko was gone from that studio, in short order. But there's not a lot of Mort Meskin pencils, Steve Ditko inks type books out there.
I'm going to do a quick song break, and then when we come back, I want to get into kind of what happened with Spider-Man and what makes Steve Ditko so, I guess, enigmatic. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay, we'll be right back. CITR 101.9 FM in Studs.
Your mentality touches up with your biology. I want the one I can't have. It's driving me mad. It's all over, all over, all over my face. A double bed and a star I'd never for sure. These are the riches of the poor. And a star I'd never for sure. These are the riches of the poor. And I want the one I can have. And it's driving me mad. It's all over, all over my face now. And somehow that really impressed me. It's written all over my face. Oh, these are the riches of the poor. These are the riches of the poor. Driving me mad, it's written all over my face. On the day that your mentality catches up with your biology, and if you ever need self-validation, just meet me in the alley by the railway station. It's all over my
CITR 101.9 FM. I didn't realize that was a live version when I put it on. Oops.
Neither did I. I was going, wait a minute, where's that coming from?
Yay! Yay! Zing Studs, we're chatting about Steve Ditko with Blake Bell. Up next week, Danny Hellman will be joining me to discuss Typhoon, his new anthology. And the week after that will be Tom Neely to talk about The Blot.
Danny Hellman is a gentleman and a scholar.
He is.
I just met him for the first time at Mocha alongside Craig Yeo, who is a damn dirty hippie.
Yep.
No, I love them both. And they didn't kill each other for those who were hoping for bloodshed.
Nah, they love each other.
Razor blades stayed sheathed, as did many other things at Mocha, but let's leave that for nighttime sales.
There we go. I'm sure I'll have lots of odd questions for Danny. He's a filthy old man, but I like him nonetheless.
He'll have lots of odd answers for you.
Oh, I know. I got to hang out with him before when I went to New York and brought me to the offices of Screw Magazine.
I hope it lived up to its name.
Not really, actually.
Oh,
okay. It was just a couple of guys in an office. But still, it's the offices for Screw Magazine. So, you know. Even though that's long gone. Back to Mr. Ditko. So, there's been a lot of attention to Ditko lately. Jonathan Ross did the BBC documentary. What was it? Finding Steve Ditko? Searching for Steve Ditko?
It was In Search of Steve
Search
Ditko.
Of Steve. There we go. See, I don't even remember names of things. Which is funny because he actually, in the process of doing it, didn't he talk to Steve Ditko? But they pretended they couldn't find him.
Yeah, they found him at the end, but they didn't go and film him going up to speak to Steve. Neil Gaiman and Jonathan Ross were outside his studio. Ross called him. Ditko basically told him to you-know-what off, according to Ross, but then they still just left the cameras downstairs and went up and talked to him and came back 25 minutes later saying that they had talked to him and Ditko had given him comics and the whole bit. And Jonathan's a very nice man. He gave us permission to show that documentary at the book launch events this summer. So we showed it at the Hanley's Universe event last Saturday after Mocha, and we'll be showing it at the Beguiling event on Wednesday in Toronto, too.
There we go. I've watched it. For those that are more technically able, you might be able to find it online somehow, but it's a wonderful documentary and really interesting look into Steve Ditko. One of the things they really talk about a lot is what happened with Spider-Man. So what did happen with Spider-Man? Because there's a lot of speculation in different stories.
What did happen with Spider-Man? There's spoiler alerts probably going to come up here, so anyone who wants to get out of the book, just start, put your fingers in your ears and go la 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 for the next 5 minutes.
Do you want to stay off this one if you want to save it for readers, or should we just go into it anyways?
Let me put it this way. We'll do this. Steve Ditko has gone on record more than once saying the identity of the Green Goblin had nothing to do with him leaving. Spider-Man. Nothing. And it's believable because, as both parties, Lee and Ditko, have admitted, they did not speak to each other for the last year, if not 13 months, while Ditko was working on that strip. Lee let him completely do it all on his own and just scripted whatever came back. So this notion that somehow, that Ditko wanted it to be a man on, off the street, which he had already done with the Crime Master in issues 27, or that, there was this whole big kerfuffle about that right before Ditko left, is all false.
Okay.
And we corroborate the ideas that we put forward, the three ideas that we put forward as to why he left Spider-Man, and as you would expect, it's just never that simple to have one. We corroborate that quite in detail. So we'll shatter the myth, that Green Goblin myth, right now, and we'll leave the rest for the readers to go and check out the book and the detail that we sort of put into it. Read the endnotes is also what I'd say with this book. There's like 5 pages of endnotes, because if you have a subject who declines to participate in a book and then also is not a fan of giving interviews for the last 30 some odd years, we really made a great effort to bulletproof the book, if you will, to really say that any time I would assert a conclusion or an opinion, Gary Groff would go back at me and say, okay, how did you come to that? And I would have, everything at the table to say it came from here, 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 and here. So I think you're going to find the definitive answers as to why, the end at Marvel came about related to Spider-Man in the book.
An academically sourced comic biography.
Quite, indeed.
I love it. Have you ever actually met Steve at all?
Yes. Back in, I think this was May of 2001, certain events conspired to have me being quote-unquote hired as their website designer. I designed the www.snyder-ditko.com, Snyder being the co-publisher of Ditko's works, and worked on that, debuted that July 4th. That's how I met Gary Groth, really, a publisher of Fantagraphics, co-publisher of Fantagraphics, at the San Diego Comic Convention when he overheard Mike Catron introducing me to someone else as that. The website came down in a flurry of fire and flames in about September of 2001, and I went to his studio in November of that year and, you know, met and talked to him face-to-face there. And then in the odd, you know, there were some letters and, you know, another conversation post that. But nothing since the actual book had, you know, ended up being announced back in, you know, early 2003.
I have a feeling he wouldn't like the book.
In the two attempts that were made very early on to contact him about this, the first was basically a letter back saying, you know, I don't have any interest in participating in the book. And the second time when Gary called him directly, you know, he was rebuffed again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that led us. And then he wrote some rather scathing essays on Gary and me that showed that even though he hadn't read the book, all he'd ever seen was the title of the book, which back then was Steve Ditko, The Mysterious Traveler, just sort of riffing on that Tales of the Mysterious Traveler comic book he had done in the 50s, and based on the radio show. That and the cover image, which is that famous Who Am I shot with this sort of the pre-hero Marvel story where that character sort of beruffled and in that big swirling wind. From that, he judged the book to be what he called a poison sandwich, and that we were anti-Ditko, and yeah, that didn't go down too well.
So it seems like your aim with the book wasn't to be sycophantic, but just to be an honest biography, just spelling out what happened and looking into what the events were.
Well, the book functions on three levels. I think there's the presentation of the artwork itself, because there's a lot of imagery in there. I think there's over 300 images, you know, not all of its artwork, some of its other people's artwork, of course, but, you know, 99% or 98% of its Ditko work.
I'd say it's like half artwork, half text, isn't it?
It's about 48,000 words, I think, at the end of the day, in a 220-page book. So, you know, rough to say if it's half, but it wouldn't be, I don't think you'd be that far off, maybe 40% text, 60% artwork, but yeah, I don't think it comes across like that. I think it's so well designed by Adam Grano, the designer there at Fantagraphics, that it literally looks like it's like a ton of artwork. You don't get the feeling that it's just, you know, some bio with, you know, one page per, you know, for artwork for every 10. So it functions on that, just purely a presentation of the work, and then as you said, it also functions as sort of a criticism of, you know, the work. Which, you know, the last chapter of the book is called The Avenging Artist, where we take a look at how successful he was integrating Ayn Rand's philosophies into that particular medium, where he was successful and where he wasn't. And then the third part of the book, which was probably going to cause the most concern or controversy, looks at, you know, how the choices he's made in his career based on, you know, that the philosophical beliefs that he developed, how that informed the actual work itself. We did try to stay away from, you know, very, you know, salacious details that really had nothing to do or didn't impact the work, you know, salacious private details. So on the one end, I think there's going to be a reaction to the book where, geez, you didn't put enough of where the bodies were buried, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other end, I think there's going to be, you know, a lot of people or a percentage of people who, you know, would only be satisfied if the book was a checklist with pictures and would think anything else is a violation.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing I think I can say is that, you know, I think I've made the right decisions in terms of, you know, finding the balance of, you know, that anything that would have been considered, you know, quote-unquote private would have been related strictly to how it informed the work and how, you know, it was based on, you know, career choices and things of that nature.
Tell me about the legacy of Steve Ditko, the influence he's had on other work.
Well, it's funny because a lot of people can quote, you know, iterations of, you know, the Jack Kirby, you know, fans turned artist and who are influenced by his style. and obviously no one can doubt that. And with Ditko, it's his style was so unique, I think, and the visual vocabulary that he had was so different from what had been seen before, it was almost impossible to ape it and not come across looking like you were just literally a copycat. I think he has more informed a lot of people's storytelling ability. Jim Starlin says that. He says more than the artwork itself. You know, his sense of the cosmic really, you know, informed by Captain Marvel and Warlock work.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's inspired more people, perhaps, to become artists based on his work than he's directly created, you know, carbon copies of, you know, people using his style to, you know, work their own.
One thing I didn't know about, and I don't know if this could be another spoiler thing, is the Frank Miller aspect, which should have appeared to me, you know. But then reading their exchange made a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, you find that out when you start talking to professionals. A lot of them, even though you don't see anything stylistically in them or you wouldn't imagine a connection, all of them were raised in some form or fashion on, you know, the Ditko Lee Spider-Man run or the Doctor Strange run or, you know, the Warren work, that beautiful wash work and the mm-hmm. pen and ink work that he did for Creepy and Eerie right after he left Marvel. And, you know, Frank Miller, I think, is also politically or philosophically at least sort of in the same, you know, ballpark as Ditko. So, you know, from comments that he made, he really appreciated Mr. A's no-nonsense, hard-hitting, you know, justice.
Yeah.
And that informed his work as he went along. So again, there's more things that you see, you know, more influences of Ditko or inspirations from Ditko in places you wouldn't have necessarily thought would have been the case, where with other artists, you can just sort of see it plain when you look at the work versus the original.
Mm-hmm. Like that authoritarian feeling of 300 really speaks of that, you know, split between good and evil.
And I think the only true representation I've seen of Ditko's Ditko's The Question character is from Miller's Dark Knight 2, you know, which everybody, you mm-hmm. know, sort of has, you know, complaints about one way or the other. But I thought he really captured The Question character in that, you know, really well.
That brings me over to Alan Moore is with The Watchmen, which was originally intended to be basically a deconstruction of the Charlton characters, half of which were all Ditko creations.
Well, and the three of the big ones in there were specifically Ditko creations. You had mm-hmm. The Captain Atom turn into Dr. Manhattan. You had the Blue Beetle, you know, Ditko's iteration of it, turn into the Night Owl. And then, of course, you had, famously, you had Ditko's The Question or, you know, Mr. A turn into Rorschach. And in that In Search of Steve Ditko documentary you're talking about, Moore says that someone had been talking to Ditko and asked him if he had read Watchmen, and Ditko wasn't sure what that was until they brought up the character Rorschach. And Ditko is alleged to have said, "Oh, yes, he's like Mr. A, but he's insane." And, of course, Alan had the, you know, the smile on his face, you know, all the while believing, of course, that it's actually Mr. A and The Question who are the insane ones, and that's, of course, who he was modeling Rorschach on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I can imagine that, you know, as Ditko, you know, allegedly is to have pointed out, that's not how he viewed that type of figure. I think it really comes down to, with Ditko, that, you know, a hero would not have the type of foibles that have been foisted on, you know, this anti-hero mentality that sort of existed in the last 30 or 40 years. To Ditko, a hero would have resolved all those concerns, and now he's ready to be a hero and go forward, whereas books like, you know, by Garth Ennis, like The Boys, those types of books, it's really about people getting powers and being corrupted by those powers and making, you know, all sorts of bizarre decisions. And, you know, Ditko's stance is, no, that's not what a hero is. A hero would have resolved those types of concerns.
And Watchmen really is the stellar example of taking that hero and deconstructing it.
Well, and I think, as Moore said, the only one with, you know, true integrity in that book is Rorschach. It's almost sad or ironic, the way, however you want to look at it, that he's painted as sort of this miserable creature in the beginnings of the book or throughout the book. But really, at the end of the day, he's the only one to call a spade a spade. He's the only one to say, no, we can't allow this to happen. And, of course, he gets vaporized for his troubles. But really, at the end of the read, I think the reason why Rorschach is so popular is not just because he's a gritty, ugly character, but because he is the only one at the end of the book who stands out with any type of integrity and consistency.
How, back to straight to Ditko, how did his own beliefs really take someone who was at the top of the comic game, Spider-Man being, you know, one of the top comics at the time, into just disappearing into nothingness, where he's become, you know, kind of a joke to a lot of people, and his comics have just gone into a world of relative obscurity?
Well, I always attempt, whenever I attempt to speak about Ditko, I always try to frame in the perspective that, you know, I'm not friends with him, I don't read his mind, so I try to frame in the perspective that I would be just sort of looking at the words that he has used in the, because for someone who's called a recluse, he certainly published a lot of essays and works on his own terms over the last 30, 40 years, you know, detailing his process and his, you know, what he thinks about this. And he has said in particular essays that really that people became obsessed with this anti-hero notion, these heroes with foibles that they could just never get over, like the drunken Iron Man. Yeah. And to Ditko's way of thinking, the reason why his stories and work have gone into obscurity is because people don't identify or have any interest in a hero who's actually heroic. Now, you can make the argument, of course, that you have to dramatize that in a way that gets people interested, which is, you know, where a lot of the concerns comes with Ditko's, you know, later works into the 70s and beyond. But he would, I guess, from the essays that I have read, he would argue that, you know, that's one of the main reasons, that nobody appreciated my independent mind work. They were only interested in the superhero stuff that was really becoming corrupted by this notion of the anti-hero. And very similar, they follow very similar paths in terms of career choices as you look at Ayn Rand's, you know, the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged characters, the Howard Roark character in the Fountainhead, who's the architect who won't compromise any of his beliefs. He literally drops down to barely being able to eat. And in the Atlas Shrugged book, of course, the John Galt character disappears into, you know, Galt's Gulch and takes the great minds of the world with him until the world is ready to, you know, value those particular minds. So from that, you can sort of see similar patterns in Ditko's career where, you know, literally the amount of publicity done on a Ditko book in the last, you know, of his own work in the last 20-some-odd years is virtually nil. And it's really just presented out there for those people who will find it, as opposed to, you know, trying to convince, you know, the irrational masses that you should read this stuff and invest a lot of time and energy in that versus actually producing work.
What were some examples of him, other than Mr. A, really speaking the way he wanted his work to have been as honest to him?
He continued onwards. Once Mr. A, he put out so much work that not all of it was Mr. A. I mean, even he had a lot of interest in the fanzine world, you know, comic book fandom, although it also caused him a lot of grief. So there was that, you know, constant push and pull. But he did a lot of stories that he would literally give away to, you know, small fanzine publishers to print because he couldn't get them, you know, incorporated into, you know, the mainstream companies. He did works. He finally gave up on that and just started self-publishing his own work. I think two of the best works that he's done are two books in the 80s. One is called Static, and one is called The Mocker. And they're better than the sort of the didactic tracks that sort of came to pass in the 1970s because they're a little more fully formed as graphic novels. So rather than just sort of 8-page hits where, you know, Ditko is suggesting that he's got to hammer you over the head with, you know, an entire, you know, philosophical premise in such a small period of time, yet also infuse sort of like a superhero type story in there as well. Those two books really work because they're able to do some type of character development and some type of actual story rather than just, as Neil Gaiman called it, you know, classic outsider American art.
I'm going to do a quick song break and then come back with more questions. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Studs. We'll be right back.
I have a picture pinned to my wall. An image of you and of me, and we're laughing with love at it all. Look at our life now, all tattered and torn. We fuss and we fight and delight in the tears that we cry until dawn. Oh, some perfect world we know we'll never find. So perhaps I should leave here, yeah, go far away. But you know that there's nowhere that I'd rather be than with you here today.
CITR 101.9 FM, this is the Ink Studs. I'm talking to Blake Bell about the artist known as Steve Ditko. Steve Ditko, he was very strong about his views, about how his work reflects his views. So what happened with Speedball?
What happened with Speedball?
Why Speedball?
I don't know what's happened in the last couple of years of Speedball. I've read the odd thing, what's happened to him, but...
But I mean, why create Speedball? That it just seems so, just didn't really reflect what he had been working on.
Well, I think in right after the whole DC Comics experience collapsed in the late 60s, where he was doing The Creeper and he was doing Hawk and the Dove. Hawk and the Dove was really, I think, his last, you know, blatant attempt to sort of fuse the superhero, you know, the mainstream superhero world with his philosophical beliefs. When that went down the tubes, you really see that separation between his highly personal philosophical work and just, you know, genre, you know, five-page the Charlton-type stories of the 1970s. There was a real break there to where he would just work on that type of material to pay the bills and then to be able to allow him to go off and do that very personal work. You even see it in the 1980s where he's doing Rom and, you know, all those
types of Rom
characters that would have, you know, you'd never think of him doing, and he wouldn't even do the inking on a lot of that material because, again, it wasn't his own personal work. So when you get to Speedball, I think Speedball was his attempt to get back to this, you know, this Spider-Man type notion of a young individual coming to grips with these special powers that he's received, and, you know, that, you know, how he would mature through that process. But again, he didn't do the finished artwork on it. I think there's the first couple issues inked by Jackson Geiss were really nice looking, but there wasn't just that depth of character that informed, you know, the Spider-Man work. So it really just, you know, fizzled out after 10 issues. Interestingly enough, my best friend of the last 25 years, Len Lambers, he had 3 letters in Speedball, in the 10 issues of Speedball. So, you know, he's a god amongst, you know, Ditko letter writers. 3 letters out of 10 issues. You know, how do you beat that? That pretty much gives you an idea of the response that it was getting, I think, from fandom, that they went back to the same guy, another guy from Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Canadian.
3 times in 10 issues. But God bless it. It would have been nice to seen that, you know, have paid off and sort of been infused by a little more character depth and a little more interesting plots, and had that continued on for him, but it wasn't to be.
Well, little info for local Vancouverites, Ed Brisson, the editor behind You Ain't No Dancer anthologies, is obsessive about Speedball. He gets anything with Speedball in it, so.
Well, I hate waiting in lines, but I do it.
We're getting close near the end, so one thing, other than picking up your book, what would be some trademark excellent pieces of Steve Ditko work that people should check out?
It's tough not to, you know, if you need something to, you know, hold up your house, you could build a foundation of a backyard with that amazing Spider-Man omnibus that Marvel put out last year that has an essay by myself in it. It's a brick. You can kill someone with it, but it obviously contains everything in that regard, so you can't miss it.
And that's got all the Ditko issues?
Yeah, pretty much, and then the, you know, all the letters, pages, everything, and a lot of extra little, you know, special features, as they say, and as the kids say in the DVD world. That amazing fantasy omnibus collects, you know, Amazing Adventures 1 to 6, and then all of those Lee Ditko Amazing Adult Fantasy books leading right up to and including, you know, the title change to Amazing Fantasy 15. That's Steve Ditko Marvel Visionaries book that I did the introduction from. It has, you know, more different types of Marvel work throughout the years, but again, he's not someone that's been mined for a lot of material, the other types of material. You know, he's in control of his own stories, so if you can find any of those, you know, the Steve Ditko collections that Fantagraphics did in the mid-80s, that would be a great introduction into those early Mr. A stories. And, you know, he did, Ditko himself obviously, you know, co-published all those Steve Ditko packages at the end of the 90s, and I think Dark Horse is reprinting the Creeper and Eerie work that he did.
Oh, Creepy and Eerie.
Creepy and Eerie, yes. Yeah. They're shooting from, you know, the comics themselves because they don't have the original artwork. But, you know, still, that's, if you can get the originals of those, or if they do a really good job with the shooting of that artwork, I mean, that's prime stuff. That's fantastic stuff. And we just announced on the Friday before Mocha that not only am I going to do a Bill Everett book in the same vein, Bill Everett, the co-creator of Submariner, but we're also looking at doing sort of a Best of Steve Ditko collection from his very earliest work, and then sort of working our way into the, you know, the 50s as a decade. So, you know, hopefully that'll, you know, give something really solid for Ditko fans to, you know, clasp onto and sort of bring together as a, you know, a body of work that people can look back on.
And I got to highly recommend checking out the Creepy and Eerie stuff, because it also, not only does it have the Ditko stuff, it also has one of my favorite, Alex Toth, working at his prime.
Well, everybody. They tried to rebuild EC, basically, and they did a great job with a lot of talent there that in one place that you hadn't seen since those days.
A young Archie Goodwin starting out with the right foot.
Indeed.
He is a mensch among men. So your next book, Bill Everett. Why Bill Everett book?
Similar to how I came across Steve Ditko, just as I came across Everett's work as, you know, as a, before I was even a teenager. There was a particular drawing in that, I think it was a Horn encyclopedia, the one with the red sort of covers around it, that had this picture of, it looked like, I guess, the Submariner just punching out the Human Torch, and they looked like they were sort of an underground cave with water, and the detail in that was so amazing and similar to Ditko. Again, just such a unique style. And he did, you know, if he had been working for EC Comics in the 1950s as a horror artist versus the work he did for Marvel, I think he'd be, you know, considered at the pinnacle. And he's another one where there's a vacuum where, you know, out there where nobody's actually done the work. It's, you know, nobody's actually taken a good hard look at that work and celebrated him in that regard. And, you know, this time, you know, the family is on board with the actual book, and I'm donating 10% of my royalties on the book to the Hero Initiative, because which supports, you know, comic artists in need from previous generations. And I think that's important to for Bill's legacy, because when Bill passed away in 1973 at an all too early age, the ACBA, which is the Academy of Comic Book or however it, association, I can't remember what exactly the actual iteration of it is, but they renamed their, they had like a welfare fund to help out cartoonists, and they renamed it the Bill Everett Fund. But that has since ceased, and now the Hero Initiative is picking up that good work. So, you know, hopefully it'll be a great project, and we'll do some good as well.
The things like the Hero Initiative, I just got to emphasize the importance, because even like looking at some of the treatment that some of the greats have gotten, we had Neil Adams on. He was talking about how, I forget which one, Siegel or Schuster, was sleeping on a couch in the 70s in an apartment in Brooklyn with a broken window. And it's like, a lot of these old guys got no money from any post-royalties that a lot of the big companies are making a lot of money off. Spider-Man.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, this is an industry where there was, you know, at the time there was no pension. There was literally what, you know, your day's work and the day's pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of cartoonists that we all love have gone on to experience, you know, a lot of medical problems and very costly. As luckily, we don't know as much up here in Canada as it would be down in the States with our Medicare system and compared to what they have down there. So, you know, the Hero Initiative, you know, really does a lot of good work. You know, to support, you know, those who were the foundation, you know, of this industry that we love to talk about so much.
And one of the things with that that you cover in the book is the discussion of original art, which is another thing that has been a loss for a lot of these artists, because a lot of the companies, this really affected Ditko, kept on to the art or threw it out, or people just stole it. So
yes, you just named the three things that probably happened to it. And yeah, Ditko was one of those people in the early days in the 70s, along with Neil Adams, that were discussing that whole issue of, you know, original art and what happens to it and who gets it and why. Ditko even wrote an essay in 1974, you know, who owns original art? He was, you know, rather than just saying, you know, I deserve it back or things like that, he was actually trying to position the notion of in a collaborative medium where you'd have a writer, a penciler, an inker, a letterer, a colorist. You know, he was asking the philosophical point of, well, you know, who owns this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a, you know, if it's a collaborative effort. So he was even asking those questions while everybody else was just sort of running around with their head cut off screaming that, you know, they should get it back, you know. There's, you know, I've heard famous stories about, you know, writers wanting pages and artists sort of cutting out the word balloons and sending them the word balloons and say, well, there's your contribution to the artwork. But, you know, so, and yeah. And then, you know, unfortunately, as I talked about earlier, those fans that Ditko entrusted to publish his artwork, his most personal stories, in, you know, the small press fanzines, some of them, you know, were very grateful to Steve for, you know, being the lead in that in fandom, and some other ones took, you know, rather, you know, poor. What's the word I'm looking for? They took advantage. They took advantage of his generosity and kindness. And we go into that in the book as well. So that's rather, not only did the comic book companies, you know, basically withhold the artwork, also some, you know, not so scrupulous fans as well, you know, did him wrong in that regard. And we detail that in the book. So
respect your artist is the lesson of the day.
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Blake.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. This is my first full hour ever podcast, and it was I'm glad I lost my virginity on the show, as I'm sure many people have once the mic goes off and the studio lights go down. You crazy Vancouverites, you West Coast
Hey now, watch it, Torontoite.
I'm calling from the center of the world. Well, north of the center of the world, but it's the center of the universe here. Didn't you know that?
I'm gonna have to
say goodbye to Trevor Linden for me.
I'm not a hockey guy. Sorry.
All right. You're the best, Robin.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for all the hard work in the Ditko book.
Thank you. You take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Once again, that was Blake Bell. You can check out more information on his stuff at comics.ditko.org. And he's got a plethora of information on Ditko. I think he even has a complete checklist of everything by Steve Ditko. So if you want to get more into Steve Ditko, check out his site. Also check out The Strange and Stranger World of Steve Ditko, published by Fantagraphics. Will be out in the next couple of weeks. The kind of hope was when we set this is that it would be out by now, but it's not. So sometimes stuff gets delayed and making its way across the ocean because a lot of books get published very far away now or printed far away. So CITR 101.9 FM. Check out podcasts, inkstuds.com. This will be posted there later today. And up next, we got Crimes and Treasons. And hopefully the boys get here soon. Bye-bye.